Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Folt, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is David Iglesias, who reads from and discusses his new book, Injustice, Inside the Scandal That Rocked the Bush Administration, published by Wiley. In the weeks to come, we have Lisa Lillian and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to The Tattered Cover. We're very pleased tonight to welcome David Iglesias with his new book, Injustice, and it proves to be a very informative evening as well. He was born in Panama City, where his parents were both missionaries. After receiving a presidential appointment as the United States Attorney General for the District of New Mexico, he was confirmed by the Senate in October 2001. He served until December 7th, 2006, when an assistant announced his resignation. David graduated from Wheaton College in Illinois, which I'm familiar with, and received his JD from the University of New Mexico. While in the Navy, he served on a legal team that inspired a few good men. So he's up to the task of letting us know what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Folks, I'll probably take about 20 minutes. One of the many things that I learned in the Navy was to be brief and be seated. But I won't be seated too fast because I know you'll have questions you want to ask. Because I know a lot of you have been following this story for probably a couple of years when TPMMuckraker.com first carried the Carol Lamb prosecution of Randy Duke Cunningham. And Muckraker has been following the story very, very faithfully. So I'm sure over the course of the past couple of years, you probably said, you know, they've never asked one of those fired U.S. attorneys this question. So this will be your opportunity. To do that. In fact, just recently I was asked by the MSNBC Morning Joe show whether the best question I had was not from a journalist, but in fact it was from a book buyer. And I said, yeah, it was. I was in Phoenix, Arizona, and I had just a wonderful question that that a member of the public had asked. So, you know, this is your opportunity. I will give a few comments, and then I really would like to hear your questions because, as you'll hear from my remarks, this matter is not over. It's still ongoing, and it's not on the front pages anymore, but it's still something that's very, very important. But I would like to thank you for coming. I know here in Denver there's lots of things you can be doing on a Friday evening, especially a beautiful July evening like this. So thanks for making time. Thanks for caring enough about our criminal justice system. Thanks for caring enough about our rule of law to make time to listen to a fired lawyer. And also thanks to Tattered Cover for setting this up. This is beautiful. I went to your Cherry Creek location back in the 90s, and I thought that's where I was going. I had no idea that there were two stores. And a friend of mine dropped me by your Lodo location. That was wonderful also. But they said you're about 15 minutes away, so here I am. Oh, so there's three now. Okay, great. Well, I just want to give you, like I said, an overview. Point number one is it's not over, ladies and gentlemen. There are still five pending investigations into this unprecedented firing. And there is a pending historic lawsuit that the House of Representatives filed against Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten. You're probably aware of that. And I joined about 24 other former U.S. attorneys, Democrats and Republicans, to argue against what we believe to be the inappropriate use of executive privilege to shield the production of information, which we believe will open up and really explain why it is that so many U.S. attorneys were given the axe for illicit reasons on the same day. Point number two, it's not about losing my job. If you remember one thing from my comments, is this is not about lawyers being fired. It's about an attempt to politicize our criminal justice system at the highest levels of our country. That's something that cannot stand. This scandal is about the importance of having independent prosecutors who base their decisions on two things and two things only. This scandal is about ensuring the rule of law in this country And finally, the scandal is about the separation of powers. Elected officials and White House advisors have no business attempting to influence the timing of indictments, investigations, or the contents of sealed indictments. Justice is blind to politics, so my comments here are neither liberal nor conservative, neither Republican or Democrat. This is a matter of right and wrong, not a matter of right or left. You may wonder, how is it that a former loyal Bushie ended up writing a book that was highly critical of the Bush Justice Department? Well, I have a friend of a friend who is a syndicated columnist in San Diego named Ruben Navarrete. I don't know if his column is in the Denver Post or not, but Ruben called me and said, you know, you really need to write a book. And I said, well, I've always wanted to write a book, but I never thought I had anything important to say. So be careful what you dream about, because sometimes those dreams come true. So Ruben gave me some ideas. I talked to an agent, and the rest is history. But in the process of talking to some major publishers in New York City, I was given a ride by a taxi driver to the PBS station, or their main station there in New York City. And the taxi driver recognized me and then proceeded to tell me why the U.S. Attorney Justice Department scandal was so important. And I thought to myself, this is very telling that someone of his background would understand and be able to articulate why this is important. I had the similar experience in Washington, D.C. as I was getting ready for a book signing in June. I was picked up by a taxi driver from the country of Senegal in West Africa. Same thing, he recognized me and he said, let me tell you why America is such a special place. And he proceeded to give great policy arguments why politics and prosecution should never mix. So this is something that resonates, I believe, not just with the educated elite like yourself, but with those who work with their hands for a living. So I wrote the book. I only had a few months to get ready. When you have time, I was out of work for 7.5 months last year, and when you have time like that on your hands, you start to learn interesting things about yourself, such as, I've got a really short attention span. And as much as I wanted to write the book by myself, I needed a co-writer, because the mountains of New Mexico beckoned, the trails beckoned me, my children and my Cocker Spaniel beckoned, and I just couldn't force myself to sit down and write it by myself. But with the able assistance of Davin C. from California, we were able to put together, I believe, what I would hope you agree after you read the book, is something that clearly lays out our case. It's meant for the non-lawyer. That's not to say that a lawyer would not find it interesting, but it's really for the layperson. While I was in the process of writing, the investigations that Congress had launched were ticking away. I was interviewed by the Senate Ethics Committee in March of 2007, just a few weeks after my testimony in Capitol Hill with my fellow fired colleagues. I was contacted by the Office of Special Counsel in April of last year and asked to consider to file a complaint against the Justice Department. I was interviewed by the Justice Department's Inspector General's Office in June of last year, and they're tasked to see if criminal laws were broken by Justice Department personnel. Then in August of last year, I returned to Capitol Hill and testified before the House Ethics Committee. I was advised not to talk about my testimony, so to quote Forrest Gump, that's all I can say about that. All the while, Justice Department officials were resigning in droves, beginning with Kyle Sampson, the chief of staff to former Attorney General Gonzalez, in March. Monica Goodling resigned. She was the White House liaison and counselor to the Attorney General. She has a dubious distinction of being the first Justice Department official to ever claim the Fifth Amendment before testifying in front of Congress. Now imagine having that on your tombstone. Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty resigned. His claim of our alleged performance-related problems was what triggered my colleagues and I to speak out, because they can fire you, but they can't slander you without there being a consequence. And Paul, who I had served with, knew better. Gonzalez, who'd been teetering on the brink of resignation, stepped down in August of last year, as did Karl Rove, the alleged brain of the president. Karl Rove, I'm not making these up. This is what he's called. Now, Karl Rove, there's another book that you can get upstairs, argues, and I've read part of the book, but the argument is this, that Rove was actually asked to step down by the president. because of the U.S. attorney scandal. That was one scandal too far, one bridge too far. So I find that interesting because I'd never heard anyone say that. But there's a book called Machiavelli's Shadow, which you may want to check out. There were others that stepped on that I don't have time to mention. My fired colleagues and I were able to figure out we weren't the only ones within about 2 weeks of our December 2006 phone call for Maine Justice. And I talk about those phone calls pretty clearly in the book. We maintained constant email and phone contact. We even had telephone conferences. The media kept on the full court press. Stories exploded. I was even interviewed by Danish and Swedish television last summer. And I asked the producer and the cameraman, why is this important to Scandinavia? And his answer was very telling. What they said was this: what happens in America matters. Whether you Americans want to admit it or not, you're the world leaders in lots of things, and we pay attention with things like this. So that was very, it's a real wake-up call to me, because I really kind of view this as an inside the America criminal justice system, but I realize there are other, our world friends were watching this very carefully also. Some days, like when Gonzalez resigned, I did more than 20 interviews, more interviews than I did in some years as being United States attorney. In fact, if you talk to any of the local media in Albuquerque, they'll say, you know, Dave was a good U.S. attorney, but he was kind of shy. He didn't do very much. He didn't do very many press conferences, which is true. I mean, I figured my job was to prosecute criminals and not my own chest, but to, you know, have an occasional press conference. So that's obviously changed. Now the latest comment by the local media in Albuquerque is that I'm talkative. Then I think I mentioned the historic lawsuit that was filed in March of this year from the House of Representatives. And I asked the House counsel, I said, has this type of lawsuit ever been filed against high-level members of an administration? He said, no. This is the first time that we can determine that the House has actually filed a lawsuit. And that's pending. So we'll see what happens in that. And if the House loses, and the issue there, folks, is can the House overcome a claim of executive privilege when the evidence is about the firings of U.S. attorneys? Because what the House wants to find out is, what's the evidence? What's the real basis? Because they know performance is not the basis. And what I've been saying, my colleagues have been saying, it's improper political interference with ongoing federal investigations. That's really the heart of what happened in Arizona, New Mexico, Missouri, Seattle, and San Diego. I still can't figure out what happened to my friend Dan Bogdan in Nevada. The best theory that makes sense to me is it's really sad, but I'll tell you. And I asked Dan Bogdan about this. He agrees. And that is, Kyle Sampson couldn't get to be U.S. attorney in Utah. So the next best thing was to be U.S. attorney in Nevada. So they wanted to just move Dan out. Dan had been serving faithfully for 15 years as a career federal prosecutor. And when you read my book, you'll see that the Deputy Attorney General gave his 15-year service to our country about a 45-second look, and then he decided to cut him loose. So very, very sad. By the way, both Harry Myers and Bolton are claiming executive privilege. If you are an insomniac and want to see what I wrote about executive privilege, go to slate.com. Punch in Iglesias and executive privilege, you'll see the article that I wrote in which I said it exists, but it does not apply in this case because the president has already stated he has nothing to do with our firing. What the law is, it protects privileged communications between the advisors and the president. But if there's no communications between the advisors and the president, how can it apply? So we'll let brighter minds than me figure that one out. Obviously, America stands for lots of good things. Among those is a fair criminal justice system, one free of political interference. What happened to me and my colleagues was not right, and we spoke out. I have no regrets, and I appreciate the support of many of you in this audience. In particular, my good friend John McKay, the former U.S. attorney in Seattle, and his older brother Mike, who was a U.S. attorney under the Reagan administration, has been tremendously supportive, as has your U.S. attorney here in Colorado, Troy Iad, who picked me up at the airport, who took me to the Denver Chop House. Is that what it's called? Is that right, Chop House? Had some buffalo, which, wow, you know. So I want to just take a second. and publicly thank Troy, who's here in the audience, for his support, because the easy thing to do would be to ignore us, just to treat us as, you know, the problem children of the Bush administration. And Troy and every currently serving U.S. attorney that I've talked to a lot, have been fully supportive of my colleagues and me. So, Troy, I'm going to give you this little pin here. So it's really good to see that there are prosecutors in across the country that get it, that get the issue. This is not about politics, or it shouldn't be. And, you know, it's been really encouraging to me to get the support from currently serving U.S. attorneys and their assistants. So when this matter is finally over, I think politicians will learn that you can't mess with justice without paying a price. And I believe that the defeat of Heather Wilson in my home district of Albuquerque was partially attributable to her phone call to me. She was beat in the primary. She lost the first race of her life. Congressman Chris Cannon from Utah called me an idiot on Fox News last summer. He said I was fired because I was an idiot. I was asked about that, and I didn't want to engage because that's not my style to, you know, launch and ad hominem attacks against people. I just said, you know, I'd like to talk about the issues, not name call. Well, I'm happy to report that Chris Cannon was beat by 20 points in the primary last month. So, when you do get the book, I'd suggest you start off looking at the appendices. They're very short, but start off with the NAFUSA. And you're probably wondering, what's NAFUSA? It's the National Association of Former United States Attorneys. Okay. And these are a group of former U.S. attorneys, Democrats and Republicans, going back to the Kennedy administration, I think. And they backed us 100%. And they issued a series of resolutions that completely support what my colleagues and I did and take to task what happened here in terms of the interference with the criminal justice system. So I also need to tell you that I'm happy that Mukasey did limit the contacts between the White House and the Justice Department. If you saw the testimony last year, there were literally hundreds of legitimate phone calls, contacts that could be made between members of the White House and the Justice Department. Now it's limited to four people can make those calls. I think that's a good step in the right direction. And I've already talked about the support. Remember, you know, this really boils down to an impartial justice system. My dad's an immigrant from Panama. I lived there for 8 years. Some of you may have immigrant families, different parts of the world. You know, this is a special country. You don't really realize that until you go overseas. I've spent a lot of time in Africa and Asia and Latin America and Eastern Europe. We have something really special here, folks. And in my view, one of the most important pillars is our criminal justice system, which was untouchable. Our Justice Department had been untouchable, and then this happened. And that's not to say that the damage is irreversible. I think with the new administration, with the new Attorney General and top people, we're going to get back on the track as where we should be. But in my view, and the view of lots of people that I talked to, both currently serving within Maine Justice throughout the field, it's not the same now. There's still that doubt. And you know, you members of the public, you have the right to believe that when somebody is charged with a crime, it's for good reason. It's not for political reasons. Anyways, I mentioned I would be brief, but I won't be seated. So I'm really looking forward to your questions because I do know that you care enough to come here. So this is your opportunity to, you know, ask me some questions. So please, I will repeat your question because I believe this is being recorded. Right, Pat? Okay. Any questions, folks? Yes, sir, in the blue.
The situation with the contempt of Congress decision on Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers. If I remember correctly, the committee has not sent that to the full House. When they do, if they are found in contempt of Congress, what happens at that point? Would that eventually go to the Supreme Court?
The question is, what happens to the contempt of Congress against Bolton and Myers? It's the committee has found contempt, has not gone to the full House. Would this go all the way? Well, it would have to first be voted on by the entire Congress, and assuming they have the votes to do it, I think they probably do. It all depends on what they do. I mean, Congress has the power to literally arrest them. I understand there's a little one-room jail in the bowels of the Capitol. I've never seen it. I hope I never get to see it. But they have the power, and this last happened, I've read, in the 1930s when somebody who refused to testify was arrested. They won't do that. But, yes, this is the kind of thing that could go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court on the executive privilege argument, because there hasn't been any Supreme Court ruling since 1974. And I see enough gray hair in this room to recognize there are people that would remember Watergate. And that's the last time there's been a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on executive privilege. One of the things that the court stated was that it's not unlimited, that it best applies in a couple of circumstances. When it comes to military or diplomatic secrets, you can understand why Congress shouldn't have the ability to force an advisor to give up what they told the president. But in this matter, they've already admitted the president was cut out of the loop. And also, this is about firing U.S. attorneys. This is not about a military secret or a diplomatic secret. So I just don't think it applies. More questions, please? Yes, sir, in the blue.
Sure. Whose political brainchild do you think this whole idea was to fire the U.S. attorney? Do you think that it was Karl Rove?
The question is, whose idea was it to come up with firing a group of U.S. attorneys? Just to give you some historical context, according to the Congressional Research Service, between 1981 and 2006, it's a 25-year period, only 9 U.S. attorneys were fired. And all of those 9 were for misconduct. And I happen to know in Florida, I'm not picking on Florida, but I happen to know 2 of the U.S. attorneys in Florida. One bit the leg of a stripper after losing a big case. He was fired because he committed a criminal act, obviously. There was another U.S. attorney from Florida who grabbed the necktie of a obnoxious local TV reporter who asked him a tough question after losing a big case. You can't grab somebody like that. That's assault and battery. He was fired. I'm aware of other instances in which U.S. attorneys have been involved in political matters, which you can't do without paying the penalty. So in 25 years, only 9, and then in one day, they got rid of 7 of us. I think what happened is, in the case of New Mexico and Missouri and Washington State, the local party officials wanted U.S. attorneys who are willing to do politically based prosecutions. So they complained to Rove, and Rove put the information together and came up with the list. I could be wrong. I believe the evidence exists. Right now it's circumstantial only, but I believe the direct evidence exists in the form of memos and emails that have not yet been produced to the House of Representatives. I hope we find out someday. Is that, yes, sir.
I'm not sure if this is the question, but is there a philosophy of criminal prosecution that you develop as a prosecutor? You don't go along with other prosecutors, but you must have a certain take. And have you ever seen a successful prosecution of lobbyists in Washington by a federal prosecutor? Because obviously, this is outrageous what goes on in Washington. It's bought and sold not before our eyes, because we're asleep out here, mm-hmm. To what's really going on. It's crazy to think we're living in a democracy when all these guys retire into being lobbyists. You just read bits and pieces of it. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
I'll see if I can capture that question. The second question, as I understood it, is have we ever prosecuted lobbyists? In fact, we just recently have. Jack Abramoff was involved in corrupting. I think you're probably right, but you need to have people willing to talk, people that are willing to cooperate with the federal authorities. I do note that there have been numerous members of Congress in the past several years that have been either indicted or convicted. Rick Renzi in Arizona has been recently indicted for corruption. And here's the ugly thing about that case. It was his press officer that called Paul Charlton, the former U.S. attorney, called Charlton's press officer and wanted to know if his boss was being investigated. It's a completely inappropriate question. and the press officer for Charlton, who was fired along with me, refused to answer that question. The sad thing, and I just confirmed this with Paul when I was with him in Arizona, that call was not reported to Congress by the Justice Department. It should have been, but it was not. Randy Duke Cunningham was prosecuted by Carol Lamb, was also fired. He was a conservative member of Congress. He took, I believe, over $3 million, I believe, is what he was convicted of. He got an 8-year sentence. Bob Ney from Ohio was prosecuted, and William Jefferson in Louisiana has been indicted. So, I mean, it's been very telling to see the level of corruption. Provable corruption that's occurred in recent years. And of course, if you remember back to the 90s, you've got Rostenkowski from Illinois, who was a powerful member of the House. So, my own theory on that, folks, is that unchecked power is not a good thing because it leads to abuse of power, which leads to breaking laws, which leads to being prosecuted. And I don't view this as a Republican problem. I view this as a problem of any party that has the House, the Senate, and the White House for a number of years and is unchecked. And I hope we don't see a recurrence of this in a number of years. But, in my view, the founders really came up with a great system of government to have checks and balances so that the coequal branches could keep an eye on each other, because power is inherently corrupting. There's a hand back there. Yes, ma'am? Right. Right.
What's your take on that case? John Siegelman's out of prison now. I don't know if he's allowed to, how fully he's been allowed to speak. But on that particular federal attorney, or any federal attorneys that remained and did this kind of political cases?
There are 84 U.S. attorneys that were not fired, and I have confidence in almost every one of them. Now, that being said, read my Harper's article that I wrote a couple days ago on harpers.com. Because the Siegelman matter, and he is speaking out, by the way. Former Governor Siegelman is hitting the circuit. He's really angry at what happened to him. And what I can tell you is, based on the 5.5 years I was U.S. attorney, I didn't have one person in my office convicted, released by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And what is that circuit over Alabama? Is that the 9th? The Fifth. Thank you. The Fifth Circuit released Governor Siegelman after reviewing the evidence. That's incredibly rare, and any practitioners out here will tell you it is really rare for a court of appeals to release somebody who's been convicted. That does not bode well for the government. I'm also aware of the Georgia Thompson prosecution in Milwaukee. She was a low-level state government employee who was also released by the circuit. What is that? The Eighth. Up there, Wisconsin. Anyway, 7th. I should have studied more in law school. The 7th Circuit released Mrs. Thompson, and the state of Wisconsin came up. They allocated money to pay for a legal defense, which tells me a lot there. I'm aware very generally of the prosecution of the county coroner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Cyril Wecht. I don't know a whole lot about the underlying facts, but those are the only three districts that I'm aware of that there have been allegations of political interference. For all the other U.S. attorneys, I have no hesitation, and I know I speak for my other fellow fired U.S. attorneys that we believe they're acting honorably. Yes, sir.
Have you talked, or any of your clients talked to former employees of other agencies who have alleged improper politicalization, such as the EPA, because you could argue that this is part of a broader pattern of corruption.
Mm-hmm. Question is, have any of my fired U.S. attorney colleagues talked to other agencies outside the Justice Department, for instance, the EPA, to see if there are other corruption matters? And the answer is no. No, we're focusing on this fight. I hope once the Inspector General's report is made complete sometime soon that that we get a letter of written retraction from the Attorney General, whoever that may be at that time. I know that I'm going to write and ask for a written retraction, because when you look at the evidence, it's not performance. And, you know, I don't want money. I don't want my job back. I want my name cleared. That's what's important to me. Yes, ma'am.
Do I like the current administration?
Who do you work for? No. You know, I like a lot of people that work within the administration, but there have been some catastrophic blunders and problems that have occurred. You know, it's been a major disappointment. I'm described accurately as a disillusioned Republican. I'm not very happy with what the party has done. I think they've squandered an opportunity. I am very, very disappointed. I suspect in a few months there'll be new leaders that'll take this country in a very different direction. And I wish them Godspeed, and I hope they don't make the mistakes that this administration has made. Yes, sir.
Are there laws which guarantee the independence of federal prosecutors and their shielding from political influence? And if there aren't such laws, should there be, and are they in the works now?
That's a really good question. The question is, are there any laws that shield the independence of United States attorneys? And if not, should there be? I'm not aware of any laws per se, with the exception of 18 United States Code 1503, and that's the obstruction of justice statute, which would apply to a United States attorney. But there's nothing that specifically singles out U.S. attorneys, and I think that's probably not a bad idea. I mean, one of the things that I've spoken out publicly about is require by law the only basis for the removal of a U.S. attorney is misconduct. So you take out the political component. And, for instance, the FBI director serves for 10 years. He's appointed by a president. He's confirmed by the Senate, but he can only be removed for misconduct. I think that's a good model to use for a U.S. attorney. I'm not saying 10 years. I think 10 years is probably too long. Right now we get four-year appointments. But it is a problem that traditionally has not come up often. You have to remember the United States attorney, as described by former Justice Robert Jackson, is the only presidential appointee that can take away your property, your life, and your liberty. The other appointees can't do that. You know, but we can, just by investigating somebody, we can ruin somebody's reputation. It's awesome responsibility. It's awesome power. And one of the best advice that I got from a federal judge when I took my job 7 years ago was, David, you have to use your power like a scalpel and not a sledgehammer, because you can ruin people's lives. And I really took that advice to heart. These questions are great. I'd like to hear some more. Yes, ma'am. No, fortunately not. The question is, were there any cases I was working on that were not prosecuted? No, the big corruption investigation that I was nearing completion when I got my phone calls from two members of Congress was filed 3 weeks after I left office. I was hoping to be able to make that my swan song. I was hoping to do my one last press conference and announce the indictment. As it turned out, my last press conference was to defend my record because I had already been labeled as a poor performer. And I should remind you, in case you've forgotten this, that USA Today ran a productivity comparison of U.S. attorneys. And the number one most productive U.S. attorney was Paul Charlton, who was fired. I was number four, and Carol Lam was number seven. So they canned three of their top performing and productive U.S. attorneys. Yes, ma'am. That's good. Yeah, Pete Domenici, you have to understand, was my sponsor. He helped me get the job. He was the grand old man of Republican politics in New Mexico. He's finishing up 36 years of service. He'd never been involved in any scandal that I'm aware of. Tom, are you aware of any scandal Pete's ever been involved in? No, he was clean, you know. But the call was wrong. And I got to tell you, I wrestled with, do I out my sponsor? Do I speak out, knowing that I'll never be able to run for office again? Because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to run for Senate or governor. But I knew if I spoke out, I wouldn't just blow up the bridge, I'd vaporize the bridge. But the more I thought about it, the more I said, you know, what happened to me and my colleagues was wrong. And if they're going to do it to me and my colleagues, they're going to do it to future U.S. attorneys. And we've got to draw the line. We've got to stop them here. So Senator Domenici announced his retirement last year, shortly after a big fundraiser that the president came. His official explanation is he has a degenerative neurological condition. I don't remember what it's called. But he's stepping down after 36 years of service. I happen to believe part of the reason may be this problem. His approval rating dipped to 40% at the height of the scandal. He'd never been anywhere near 40%. And, you know, I don't harbor any bitterness toward anybody. I feel sorry for him. He stumbled at the finish line. I had a neurologist come up to me at my Albuquerque book signing and say, you know, let me tell you something about his disorder. It doesn't affect memory, but it affects behavior. And I believe, from a medical perspective, he wouldn't have made the call but for this disease. So I'm willing to give him the benefit of that doubt. But that being said, you know, those of you who are parents, if you have people that act out, have children who act out, there has to be a consequence. And I think he did suffer a consequence. More questions. These are great. Yes, sir, in the green tan. Oh, I'm, yeah.
74?
Oh, you bet. I was in high school.
Okay. Then can you contrast the Saturday night massacre with what brought me here tonight?
Which was this matter?
Yeah. Can you compare the injustice of those two eras?
There are some similarities, so much so that the House of Representatives, in their first sentence of their brief, invoked Watergate. And we have one signer in our brief that had been a young congressperson during Watergate. The only difference that I can see right now, because there was an attempt to get the Attorney General to fire Archibald Cox, because Cox was closing in on President Nixon. And the Attorney General refused and was fired. And they finally got Robert Bork to do it, who I think was like an acting deputy or something. The only difference that I see right now is in Watergate, it went all the way to the top. Nixon didn't order the break-in of the Watergate, but he assisted in covering it up. There's no evidence that I'm aware of, and correct me if you all know something. I'm not aware of President Bush being part of this process. I am aware that Karl Rove was. Senator Domenici called Rove and complained about me that I wasn't moving cases fast enough. And the cases he was talking about weren't the rank-and-file cases that my office prosecutes, the narcotics and immigration cases. It was the alleged voter fraud cases that I refused to prosecute for lack of evidence. And I wasn't moving the indictment of Manny Aragon, a legendary Democrat state senator, fast enough for their liking. But all that is to say there are similarities, sir, but I don't believe it reaches all the way to the top. But I think it goes pretty close. Yes, sir.
Is your concern after the election that the House Ethics, the lawsuit that they have in court right now, or that they're planning to do, that would somehow just go away?
The question is, what about the House lawsuit? Will it dissipate after the election? Well, it's funny you'd ask that question, because when I had dinner with the House counsel, I asked him that question. I said, what happens with the new Congress? He goes, well, nobody really knows, because there's an argument to be made that the contempt citations are only good for the Congress, for the session that issues them, that once there's a new Congress, they go away. But he goes, it's never been tested, so no one really knows the answer. But he goes, we really want the rocket docket. That's why we asked for an expedited schedule, and that's why the district judge in Washington gave them a hearing back in June. So I think the honest answer is no one knows. But right now there is an interest by House leadership to see this through the end. Yes, ma'am. So what's the range of possible outcomes for – well, I mean, there's already been a consequence, obviously, in terms of employment for Gonzalez and a lot of his top people. But in terms of possible criminal activity. Pay attention when the Inspector General report is completed, which ought to be any day now. They may take John McKay's advice at heart, which is to appoint or recommend the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate and file charges. Now, there's a weakness in that, and that is the administration has to approve the special prosecutor, and I don't imagine that's going to happen. But for a tremendously well-written Law Review article, go to Seattle Law Review and look up Train Wreck at Main Justice. And you can pull that up, because McKay argues very forcefully that what Gonzalez did was obstruction of justice, and possibly some of his top deputies. I happen to believe that Michael Elston, who was the chief of staff for the deputy, attempted to intimidate the U.S. attorneys who were then speaking out. I wasn't speaking out then. I was still in my shy phase. But Elston said to Bud Cummings, the fired U.S. attorney from Arkansas, if you guys keep talking, we're going to throw you under the bus. And he also made the comment, we're going to take the gloves off if you guys don't be quiet. That's a classic case of attempting to silence a witness from speaking out. And Elston, to his discredit, was a career federal prosecutor. He knew better. But, he just chose his words wrongly. He's being sued in the class action lawsuit because he was part and parcel of the politicization of the Honors Program, which is a nonpartisan program to bring in bright young law students into DOJ. So, worst case scenario, you could see indictments in the future. I think most of the statutes of limitations are 5 years for witness intimidation and obstruction and conspiracy. But the next administration is going to have to wrestle with it. And I'm not aware of McCain or Obama saying anything one way or the other. But if you're aware of something, please tell me. Yes, ma'am.
What is your expectation for the next Justice Department? I mean, how far – we've been told by people who work for the federal government the politicization of all of these government agencies is so deep that, it used to be just a couple of people at the top of each agency were political appointees in the last 8 years, but they've lowered that down to, quite mid-level positions, and so even if the administration changes, that these people are still going to be there. Is that going to be true in the Justice Department?
The question is, what about in the Justice Department, what happens to people who are brought in through improper political means but now have career positions? Is this going to be a problem for the Justice Department? I've heard a little bit about other departments having these types of problems, but my focus, for obvious reasons, has been the Justice Department. I do know that the Justice Department is a huge organization. There's 110,000 or so people that work in it. I do know that the career people get the work done. The political appointees come and go. I haven't heard from numerous sources that this is a problem. I'm taking a wait-and-see attitude. I mean, I hope what you're saying is not right, because it could cause some real problems for future administration. Yes, sir, in the green.
It was your mention of Abramoff that is a segue into my question, and that's that you and your fellow attorneys were fired in December of 06, but in 2002, the day before, the U.S. attorney of Guam named Frederick Black was about to issue subpoenas to Jack Abramoff. He was removed pronto, as soon as Karl Rove in the White House knew that he was about to issue subpoenas to Jack Abramoff. After 11 years of service, he was immediately demoted, taken out of his position, and therefore in 2002, this politicization of the Justice Department had already started. And so it's not just the seven attorneys in December of 06, but 4 years earlier, Rove initiated this whole process at that time. So therefore, how come is it that we do not hear about Frederick Black and the quashing of the subpoenas to Jack Abramoff that has Rove's fingerprints all over it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I do remember meeting Fred at some U.S. attorney conferences. He's a legend because nobody serves for 11 years anymore. I mean, it's really remarkable. I know. And the official explanation that I've heard is that subsequent administrations tried to get their own people in and they couldn't pass background investigations. So, I don't know if that's true or not. And I'm aware of the Abramoff quashing of those subpoenas. Well, I think that's something else that needs to be investigated, by the Senate. There's oversight that strikes me as something that needs to be added to the list of politicization. Pat? Question was, what about the press's role? Has the press lived up to their obligation to, expose this kind of thing? Overall, I've been happy with the press. And I specifically name both the mainstream press and the alternative press. They've covered this story a lot. That being said, I'd much rather be able to talk for 30 minutes on a Bloomberg or to give a multi-hour interview to a Santa Fe reporter than I do 6 minutes to Chris Matthews. Because I found that in the past year and a half, the industry standard is between 5 and 6 minutes, and that's including their questions. And so, I mean, it's hard. This is a big issue, and it affects lots of people. And it was really – I had to train myself to really be able to talk in sound bites. And I can do it, but I'd rather be able to speak in complete sentences. So I think if I were to give the media a grade, I would say the alternative press I'd give an A. I'd give the mainstream about a B overall. Yes, sir.
2 minutes ago, you said that not only were your bridges burnt, but they were melted behind you. And I would have rather thought that your heroism would be rewarded. But having said that, as you did, I wonder what the selection criteria for a U.S. attorney is, and if it's independence of thought or action, or even the ability to dissent from the people you work for, is that among them? So question, what are the selection criteria for U.S. attorneys, and what are the selection criteria for the cases that they're asked to follow to their
okay. Let's see if I can capture those questions. What's the selection criteria for U.S. attorneys? Does it include things like being independent and being able to dissent? I can answer no to the second question. In fact, Todd Graves, the former U.S. attorney from Kansas City who ran for statewide office as a Republican, told me that he was asked to describe himself in one sentence, and he said independent. He said, I'll give it to you in one word, independent. And he says that wasn't the question. That wasn't the answer they were wanting to hear. What they're looking for is somebody who is supports the president's platform that was probably active in the campaign. Someone who has experience, hopefully in criminal law, and if not in criminal law, at least in civil litigation, because your office is going to be in court a lot. There's a minimum age. I don't remember what that is because I'm 50 now, so it doesn't really matter. They tend to be members. We're almost in all cases. I mean, for instance, I'm aware that President Clinton had one Republican U.S. attorney. That was a guy that I worked with, Paul Warner, in Salt Lake City, Utah. And President Bush had Bogdan was an independent and Carol Lam was an independent. There may have been others that I wasn't aware of. But typically, you remember the president's party. In my case, what Domenici was asking me is, had I ever run a law office before? Unfortunately, I had. I'd run several. I'd been the head of that legal office. And had I ever been a prosecutor? Because most of what my U.S. attorney's office did was prosecute cases, although we have a very robust civil section. And, yeah, I'd prosecute people for the state of New Mexico. I'd also, in the military justice system, represented sailors and Marines who were being court-martialed. So, I mean, I could find my way around a courtroom, which is nice to have. Yes, sir, in the blue, dark blue polo.
It appears that we've had a history of intimidation almost from the top down across the board for not just the Justice Department, but many other areas of government. Do you think that your circumstances and the action of the House is a stepping stone toward bringing this to an end?
I'm not sure I am following. Could you ask me a follow-up question, please?
There seems to be intimidation throughout the government, by the government, through its employees, through its people. Do you think that this action that you've had, I'm just trying to get my point across, that will do something to help turn that intimidation around to where the government can
stop intimidating
without having to intimidate its people.
Let me see if I can capture this. I think the question is this. There's a lot of intimidation going on by the government and other departments besides justice. Does the fact that my colleagues and I spoke out, will that lead to there being less intimidation in the future? I think for a season that's probably true. Especially for federal prosecutors because of the enormous responsibilities we have. You have to understand, we all passed rigorous background investigations by the FBI, checking criminal history, drug use, alcohol abuse, everything. I mean, they got into our knickers, you know, so to speak. They picked on a group of people that not only were uniquely qualified to speak out, but were used to speaking out in public forums. I mean, all of us had done media. All of us had tried cases. All of us had testified in front of Congress. So, and I don't want to put too fine of a point on this, but they picked on the wrong group of people. And when they crossed over that line and started to impugn our reputation, that was it. I mean, that's what triggered all this. In fact, I talk in my book about former Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey, who was watching his successor testify. And when McNulty said they had performance-related problems, Comey says to his wife, he just lit the powder keg. And I think that's completely accurate. You know, prior to taking another question, I want to acknowledge my wife and my four daughters that have just come up from Albuquerque. So, Cindy, would you guys stand up, please? Thank you. My daughter, Marissa, has been in cheerleading camp all week. So if she falls asleep, it's not because I'm boring, but it's because she's really tired. Yeah. Yes, sir, in the blue. Right.
I think the person most experienced in different areas is the governor of New Mexico. And yet, Obama came up with, you know, roughly half, and Hillary Clinton was half. And somewhere I saw a total where he got half of 1% or something or other.
That sounds right.
It's troubling to me, and I wonder if you could comment on the possibility of what is now the largest minority being sort of quietly second-read by the press. And, if no attention is paid to Hispanic individuals.
The question is, what about Bill Richardson, who's eminently qualified, didn't do very well in the presidential campaign? Although I think if Obama wins, he's the presumptive Secretary of State because he does have an excellent background in that outside chance of being vice president, although he's going to have lots of competition. I guess the heart of your question is, do I feel that Hispanics or Latinos have been neglected by the media? What I can tell you, in my case, they haven't. I mean, they've been very, very fair. They've not treated me like a second-class citizen. They've not presumed that I have a specific type of background. You know, I think a lot of that problem is that because of the large number of illegal immigrants of Hispanic background, people tend to think that all Hispanics have come to this country illegally. If you know anything about New Mexico, nothing could be further from the truth. I had a guy in my office whose ancestors came in 1598. which is before the Pilgrims got here. I mean, so, you know, there are most Hispanic citizens are patriotic. They pay taxes. They're in our military. They serve honorably. But that being said, I think the dynamics in Washington are still black and white in terms of race. And I don't think the community has really made inroads yet. I think that's going to happen. That's beginning to happen now as you start seeing more Hispanic candidates being groomed and whatnot. But that's, I guess that's a long roundabout way of saying I've felt like the media has been fair to me. And my ethnicity has almost never come up. Are the voters biased based on the result? You know, I haven't really studied that question all that carefully, to be honest with you. You know, the thing to keep in mind about Hispanics, folks, is it's not a racial category, because there are Hispanics that are primarily European that could pass for Anglos. There are some like myself that are of indigenous ancestry that are primarily Indian, but not from North America. And then there are lots of Hispanics that are of African ancestry. If you go to the Caribbean, you know, lots of Spanish speakers, you know, there who are primarily black. So it's an ethnic description. What binds us together is the language. And that, you know, Spanish is one of three languages that I learned growing up. I spoke it at the airport today, as a matter of fact. It's something I'm very proud of. It's something I wish I would have passed on to more of my daughters. That's my problem. Let me take some other questions. These are really good. Sir, way in the back in the gray shirt there. Well, because, and the question is, why do I think I'm precluded from running for office? And if you don't know this, which you probably wouldn't unless you've already read the book, I ran for state attorney general 10 years ago, and I got slightly under 49% of the vote. In fact, there's a gentleman in this room that helped me get that well. And Tom, thank you for coming, you know, down from, you know, from your community. Because loyalty is the preeminent quality that political people look for, and I committed the unpardonable sin of speaking out against a fellow Republican, not only once, but twice, and in multiple venues. You know, loyalty has its limits, and what I did was considered so egregious that I doubt that a lot of Republicans would ever support me. I appreciate you calling me a hero, sir. I'm not one. I just did the right thing. I'm glad I... Thank you. I have lots of friends that are Democrats and independents, and no, I'm going to stay out of politics for a while. I've got four daughters to put through college, and you know, it'll be that. The gentleman in the blue shirt there. Let me see if I capture that comment and question well. There's always a tension between the White House and the Attorney General, because a lot of times the president picks a friend to be Attorney General who's obviously going to be loyal and may not give him the best legal advice, which was true in John Mitchell's case. Getting back to Watergate, Mitchell was a personal friend of President Nixon, and it led to his imprisonment and conviction. On the other hand, you had Janet Reno, who did not like Bill Clinton and vice versa. And, you know, while she had some bad things happen on her watch, no one ever said she was corrupt. So, yeah, it's a tough balancing act, because every president wants to have people that support their agenda. But if they're smart, they don't want yes people, because yes people get you in trouble. Because they never say, boss, you can't do that. And sometimes that's what a good attorney general does. He says, Mr. President, Madam President, you cannot do that for these reasons. And if you do, here's the consequence. And that's the kind of straight-up advice that a president needs. Pat, how many more minutes do I have?
Two more.
Let me ask somebody who's not asked any questions. So if you haven't asked any questions, yes, ma'am.
All right. I know better than to ask an attorney what he thinks somebody else thinks.
Objection.
You had mentioned before that the administration messed with the wrong guys, so to speak. And my question, which I am asking in all sincerity, even though it sounds funny, is what were they thinking? Do you think that it was a knee-jerk reaction? Do you think that it was that they really didn't think that you were going to speak out? Was it based on some deep conviction founded on something that we don't see, which this administration has done in the past?
So let me see if I capture this. What were they thinking to fire us, given what happened later? Did they think they would get away with it? Oh, absolutely. Because you have to remember, in January of 06, they let go of Todd Graves. They put in a guy named Brad Schlossman, who filed some very suspect voter fraud cases. And Brad, by the way, whom I know personally, his matter is being referred to a grand jury in Washington, D.C. for possible perjury. Brad may have misrepresented himself in front of Congress. But anyway, they got away with that with Graves. And then with Cummings, they put in a guy whose only qualification to be U.S. attorney was doing opposition research against Al Gore. Now, that doesn't qualify you to be a crime fighter, to prosecute cases, to meet with victims' families like I used to do, like Troy had to do. I mean, they got away with it in Cummings' case and in Graves, no blow-up. And then I think they thought, well, if we can do it to two, let's get rid of these others that aren't playing ball with us. And then they made the mistake, like I said, of all seven in one day on Pearl Harbor Day. And then they miscalculated, not realizing we were more than just colleagues. We're friends. I mean, I've broken bread with these people. You know, I know their families. I'll be in contact with them for the rest of my life. And then they slandered us as we were on our way out. So what were they thinking? They weren't. And John McKay has the perfect one-sentence summary. He goes, it was a combination of arrogance and incompetence. And then Bud Cummings adds to that, it was a poor plan, badly executed. I think that kind of says it all. I can take one more question. If you haven't had a chance to ask me, please. Yes, ma'am. Wow, that is so big. The question is, the country's in a lot of pain. What would I give my advice to a new administration? Boy, that's a hard one. Makes me think of, I once answered a question at the Santa Fe Capitol a few months ago to a group of high school kids, and they asked me about stem cell research, and I completely whiffed that one. Let me see if I can just be as simple as possible, and just ask them to do the right thing, not the politically expedient thing, to remember why America is so special, that we are world leaders, and, you know, it may call for sacrifice. It may call for us to, you know, have to not drive our cars as much, but it really boils down to let's get this country back to where it should be. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take time. But let's at least identify the problems. And you know what? Let's stop vilifying each other, you know? I mean really. I get so tired of the name-calling on both sides. Let's, you know, we're in a special place. We disagree with each other. That's okay. But we don't have to name-call. You know, and I hope we get a new crop of leadership that are able to respectfully disagree with each other without, you know, stooping down to calling people names. Let's treat each other with some respect and hopefully, you know, work together and compromise. That's all I have, folks. I really appreciate your questions. Thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour.
I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Lisa Lillian and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on July 25th, 2008.